Good afternoon, and may it please the court, I'm Brett Barkin, the district attorney for the 14th Judicial District. With me today is Matthew Chesfold, who's our chief deputy district attorney in Moffitt County, where this case is from. We're here today to ask this court to reverse the 35C, and I'll refer to Judge O'Hara as a 35C judge in this case, just to distinguish him from the trial judge. We're asking that this court reverse his decision to grant Mr. Herrera a new trial. We're asking that this court reinstate his convictions and ultimately, by virtue of this court's order, return to the Department of Corrections. I'm going to be asking to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Let me start by saying that this court does have jurisdiction to hear this appeal. The people have stated three issues that are fully questions of law, or at least mixed questions of law and fact, the people's view. Specifically, regarding new evidence or not, the people contend that the 35C court applied an incorrect legal standard. He says he applied the Nunes case, but he didn't go on to apply the Farrar decision that elaborates on the third prong of the Nunes case. Additionally, we believe that the trial court, the 35C court, applied the wrong legal standard and did not have factual support for his findings of fact regarding effective assistance of counsel. And finally, there's the 35C court applied no legal standard that I can divine nor have factual support in the record for what I believe he did in bolstering his decisions with cumulative error. So let me start by first saying the parties appear to agree that the standard of review in this court is an abuse of discretion standard. As this court knows, the legal conclusions are reviewed de novo, and factual matters are deferred, this court defers to those facts as long as they're supported in the record. Let me turn first to new evidence. As this court well knows, sanctity and finality of jury verdicts in this jurisdiction are protected, and the court's decision in Farrar, I think, talks. The Colorado Supreme Court's decision in Farrar talks a lot about the high bar that has to be set to disturb or invade the sanctity of the jury's verdict. We're asking that this court apply that high bar in Farrar to the facts before it here. Specifically, Farrar said to get a new trial for new evidence, the information has to do more than impeach. The people contend that everything about what is new about this evidence is purely impeachment and impeachment only. Moreover, Farrar said that the new evidence had to affirmatively be probative of the defendant's innocence. That's not happened here at all.
But doesn't Farrar also say that if the evidence would go to the non-existence of the crime itself, that the evidence can come in and can be the basis for setting aside the conviction?
It does, Your Honor. But what I would argue is when the court says no impeachment, you can't backdoor by saying, okay, well, if it's impeaching because it didn't happen, that seems to me to backdoor the Farrar standard that if it's purely impeachment, it doesn't warrant a new trial. What I think Farrar meant by that was that somebody else did it, that there's some there's an alibi that it establishes that the defendant wasn't present. That's what I take that to mean, Your Honor. Finally, if there's a recantation, and I want to make it clear, there's no recantation here whatsoever. The new evidence had to do with a different matter, different time and place, a different subject, and there's nothing new about the substance of the crimes for which the defendant was convicted. That was before the 35C court or is in this court in the record for this court to review. So in the people's view, there's nothing that would support a rise to the level sufficient to grant a new trial. And what we will do is I will ask this court to apply the Farrar standard. I think the record is sufficient for this court to make its own decision that Farrar was not satisfied. In fact, there's no reading of the record that could lead to any other conclusion than this evidence is purely impeaching, therefore, as a matter of law, should not justify the granting of a new trial.
Did Judge O'Hara make any findings specifically directed to whether it went beyond impeachment or not?
Not in my reading, Your Honor. What he did do is say it's really, really impeaching. And that seemed to be, he seemed to focus on the language in Nunes that talked about it can't be merely impeaching or cumulative. And he seemed to focus on merely, he said it's not just merely impeaching, it's really, really impeaching. But that, I would argue, doesn't get us past Farrar. Farrar was itself a recantation of the sexual assault in that case. Here we don't have any recantation of the facts. We just have that somebody's attacking the credibility yet again of our victim. Our victim was attacked very effectively, not effectively from the defendant's perspective, but attacked relentlessly at trauma by the trial defense counsel. The people would argue that that, you know, as we get into the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, that that is another indication that the trial defense counsel, in people's view, picked a solid theory defense, applied it relentlessly, and if I may, I'll transition now to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Standard review there, as the court knows, is the same abuse of discretion standard, except this is a mixed question of law and fact. And the court, the people would argue, the real focus needs to be on, does the counsel's performance appear to be so deficient in light of the Strickland standard that it warrants a new trial? Here, we have insufficient record evidence to support the trial court's conclusions of fact, and moreover, we have a misapplication, in my view at least, of the Strickland standard. The court fell prey to the very concerns that Strickland articulated about distortive effects of hindsight. He failed to apply that level of deference you would expect to be applied to a defense counsel's performance. He failed to look at it in the light of the circumstances, as Strickland said, in the light, in the people's view, of the record and her performance as trial defense counsel.
Did the defendant present any expert evidence on an attorney saying that the performance of trial counsel was deficient?
No, Your Honor. The defendant at the 35C proceeding did not present expert witnesses to say they talked about the standard of performance.
Right.
Did present a defense expert on expert witnesses, but that not that established the standard of performance for the trial defense counsel, and that her performance somehow failed. Certainly, the arguments were all to that effect, but not there wasn't any evidence that I recall in that proceeding.
The expert on expert witnesses. Did the expert somehow say that the expert that the prosecution had presented at trial was out to lunch on a number of matters?
He did, Your Honor, and the trial defense counsel's claims, when they're analyzed, and I think, and I certainly invite the court to look at the entire record of the case, but I would invite the court to spend some extra attention on what exactly the people's expert said at trial, what the defense expert said she said at the 35C proceeding, and then what Judge O'Hara said about all of that. And the people would contend, to boil it down, the defendant's expert built a straw man that had to do with whether the people's expert at trial was being predictive in her testimony. And that straw man then, Dr. Tompkins, the defense expert, proceeded to knock over and say that was an incorrect application of this theoretician, Dr. Mnuchin. When one looks at the people's expert's testimony at trial, Cheryl Young was her name, she doesn't say anything at all like that. Her testimony was entirely descriptive. It was carefully cabined to be descriptive only, to not in any way predict that there was anything about the features of that, the families that she described, that would lead one to conclude that there was incest. And so all of the things Dr. Tompkins said to that effect were wrong, and not supported by the record. And yet, the 35C judge in this case embraced them, seemingly, without analysis, without confirming that in fact was what was in the record, and adopting them in his order. And so consequently, those factual findings in the people's view are simply not supported at all by the record. And as the court has read the briefs, I won't go through and recite every instance, but let me pick one example and then move along. At page 10 of the 35C judge's order, he says, quote, she, referring to Ms. Young, opined that without even interviewing any of these family members, this family fit the profile of an incestuous family. That is nowhere in Cheryl Young's testimony. Nowhere. It is more or less in what Dr. Tompkins says she said, and therefore, consequently, has no basis in the record, was uncritically adopted by the 35C judge, and just can't stand. It can't stand as a predicate fact for the conclusion that the trial defense counsel's performance was somehow constitutionally inadequate.
Mr. Barkey, if we agree with both of the arguments you just made, both as to the recantation and the failure to call an expert, do we have to remand it to the trial court to make findings and conclusions on all the remaining errors that the defendant claims?
Well, to start, Your Honor, I would argue that this court can make the decisions about the two issues presented to it. I believe that this court can look at the record that's before it and could identify that the other claims that Judge O'Hara, the 35C judge, decided not to address that were not sufficient for him would not merit this court's attention either, and therefore could affirm based on what it is without remand. Certainly, as the lesser alternative, a remand might be appropriate if this court found something amongst all of the claims, the dozens and dozens of claims that the defendant makes in this case, literally throwing issues at the wall, specious, I would argue many of them are. I think this court would remand in that instance.
Mr. Berkey, you're at 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Your Honor. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Judge. Brad Gundy, bar number 24385, representing Julius Cesar Herrera, the appellate in this case. Judge, Mr. Herrera would like you to affirm the trial court's order that vacated his conviction and sentence based on newly discovered evidence and ineffective assistance of counsel. Mr. Herrera, all he's ever wanted since 2002 and 2003 is a fair trial. He didn't get a fair trial the first time. The 35C judge saw that, vacated his conviction, and now he's set for another trial. The question that the 35C judge wrestled with for over a year, we had the hearing in June of 2012, and we didn't get an order until the June of 2013, was whether Mr. Herrera actually committed these atrocious crimes for which he was convicted. The 35C court took a look at the record, not just the jury trial record, but the whole record, conducted a three-day hearing with evidence, with expert witnesses, other testimony, and came to the conclusion after reviewing the whole trial record, including not just the jury trial transcripts and that, but the pretrial hearings and everything else, and came to the conclusion that Mr. Herrera didn't get a fair trial. As far as the newly discovered evidence, the court applied the Muniz case. Actually, it's the Gutierrez standard, I think, is the first case that came through with it. Farrar expounds on that, but it expounds on the last two of the four pieces of that case. One was referred to by Justice Berger here. They call it consequential. It's the material part. Why is this evidence material? I would put it to the court that it is material. It is consequential because of the language that Justice Berger referred to in Farrar, that it's evidence that a crime may have not even been committed at all.
How is that evidence about another incident constitute evidence that this incident may not have been committed?
What happened was basically, on May 5th, 2003, there was a hearing, a pretrial hearing, the public defender filed a motion to get in certain issues as far as breach of evidence, basically. And they alleged that it was false allegations of sexual contact, basically. In the 35C hearing, when A.H. testified on the stand, I asked her questions about three separate incidents. One was alleged sexual assault involving her uncle, M.B., with her. The other one was involving her maternal grandmother and her sister, B.H., and the third was involving her uncle, M.B., and his daughters, who would be A.H.'s cousins. In each question, A.H. said that she had lied previously for all three of those issues. And so that's where it comes in, is basically, there's an exception to the ratio standard in 18.347 to allow for false allegations of sexual assault. She admitted that she had not one, not two, but three of those that she had lied under oath a couple times as far as those go.
Did she admit that she had lied under oath about this particular alleged crime, the crime that was the subject of this case?
No. No, and that's what makes it a little different. In Farrar, they talk about discretion, the discretionary nature of newly discovered evidence. And Mr. Barton's correct, this is not a recantation case. It's a newly discovered evidence case that has a recantation aspect to it. But she's not saying that the alleged crime never happened, as far as in the 35C, she was adamant that it did happen. And that's been her testimony throughout all stages of this case.
But doesn't Farrar say that in a case involving newly discovered evidence, if the newly discovered evidence is only impeaching and doesn't, as Judge Daly pointed out, go to the specific crime for which the defendant was convicted, that it doesn't cut it? It doesn't meet the standard for a new trial? Please tell me how you think you can get around Farrar in that way.
Farrar, they talk about, and they use an example in Farrar about the rule evidence 613, where it's just merely impeaching. The 35C judge actually refers to that in his order and says that this isn't just merely impeaching evidence. It's not whether she testified whether a house was green or blue. It goes right to the heart of the matter. The 35C judge made findings that it was consequential in that, based on the language that you cited in Farrar, that that A.H. Didn't tell the truth about these three other sexual assaults, therefore a crime may have never even been committed at all. It's basically a question for the jury to decide. I think what the judge was wrestling with was basically kind of the gatekeeper function that the trial court works with. Basically, what they were looking at was trying to figure out if this evidence, if A.H. lied about these, then she may have lied about that. And that's a factual issue for a jury to decide. And I think
isn't that classical impeachment? I mean, isn't that impeachment and only impeachment?
And Farrar talks about that too. They talk about that it's consequential in that it's firmly probative of the defendant's innocence. And I guess that's the hard thing to wrestle with in this, that there's these allegations out there that she testified that she made up, and therefore the actual case, that there may not be a case at all. And that's the problem you run into in a case like this, is the main testimony at the trial was the testimony of A.H. and the testimony of the expert witness, Cheryl Young. The district attorney talked about that too in their closing. Special prosecutor talked about it several times. He started right off the bat and said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a look at Cheryl Young's theories, and we're going to apply it to the facts that A.H. presented. And if you see it, the language she used was, they'll mesh like a glove. And so I think that's where you run into it, is basically it's consequential in that it's the only evidence out there that Mr. Herrera committed a crime. And so it's impeaching in the sense that it's 613, but it's not that, you know, A.H. was convicted of writing bad checks, or that she lied on a report card or something like that. It's not saying that she has a hard time telling the truth, and therefore she's not truthful here. What it goes for is that these three sexual assaults she testified about under oath never occurred. Therefore, this one may never have occurred. And so that's where I think it's consequential.
But Farrar doesn't say that only unimportant impeachment is within the rule of Farrar. Farrar says all impeachments are within the rule of Farrar. It sounds to me like your argument, frankly, is upstairs, not here, because we have to follow Farrar. We have no choice.
And I think you may be right, Judge. It's an issue to be wrestled with as far as where do you draw the line between what's straight impeachment and what is that consequential evidence? Because Farrar discussed that as well too, and I think that's just I think that what you're looking at, and you may want to look at the other language in Farrar too, when they talk about acquittal, the evidence standing on its own, and the credibility of the actual person that testified. The credibility, the 35C court talked about the credibility of AH, and her story has never changed as far as the sex assault that gave rise to the charges in this case. She's been a credible witness all the way through. It may go towards, it may be that with these three other claims, she was credible on that too. They had a hearing on May 5th, 2003 to try to get in this evidence, and based on those false allegations, or based on the false testimony under oath, those allegations were never heard by the jury. I think that's what concerned the judge. As far as a couple of other things, as far as Justice Daly talked about the performance of trial counsel being deficient and the expert being asked to lunch, the defense expert in the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, the defense expert basically said a couple things about the testimony from the prosecution expert witness. He said basically a couple of key things. One, that the expert witness misapplied the underlying theories of the Dr. Salvador Mnuchin. In basically when she talked to the jury and drew the chart and said, here's where the boundaries are for a regular family, here's where the boundaries are for incestuous families. The expert witness also said that there was, the defense expert witness also said that there was a significant problem with her testimony in that an absent mother in that case is not the same as having a deceased mother, that it can't be predictive. And what I think the 35C judge did was not only look at the whole jury transcripts, but did the whole hearing, reviewed all the transcripts from the 35C hearing, and under People versus Dunlap, he's allowed to assess the credibility of witnesses at the 35C hearing. That's what trial judges do in the 35C hearings.
Mr. Jungi, do you think there are any instances in Judge O'Hara's order, factual determinations that are incorrect?
I think there's a couple of straight factual determinations that the judge made that are factual. I think the other things that he was talking about, and if you read the language of his order, he makes conclusions that Cheryl Young opined this, that basically, and he's taking inferences from what she testified to, and said that basically the result of her testimony was that basically she gave these theories, and the DA took, you know, block A and sort of inserted it into slot A and B and C. And
but he was incorrect in a couple of assertions of what the expert testified to, was he not?
I think what he was doing was he was reaching conclusions based on his review of the whole trial record. I think he was looking at the 35C case and the testimony in the 35C and giving it the way that it reported, and then trying to assess what the impact of Cheryl Young's testimony was. He said it was devastating. There were some factual things that he was correct on. Cheryl Young testified at the 35C hearing that the Dr. Mnuchin's theories were what she based her chart on. She also testified to that on June 28th that the deceased mother would have the same impact on an incestuous family as an absent mother.
Was this a question of a failure to adequately investigate that the DA's expert witness? Was that the deficiency for which the trial counsel, supposedly failed?
I think the deficiency was a couple things. Was basically there was there was a, and Cheryl Young testified to, or not Cheryl Young, Cheryl Ullman, the public defender testified to it at the 35C hearing, that there was a pretrial 403-702 hearing, not a full-blown Shrek hearing, but a, that type of hearing. She didn't have an expert then. She testified that she had reviewed some of the transcripts from other cases and thought she could keep her testimony out.
Is the result of this basically a per se rule that defense counsel must always have an expert around?
I don't think so. I think the judge tried to narrowly tailor it, and in the order he says that, in the order he gives deference to that. That basically, usually, and he says that that it's usually a strategic or a tactical decision on whether or not to have an expert. But he said the unrebutted testimony of Cheryl Young in this case was so devastating to the defense case that the public defender had an obligation in this case. I don't think it makes a per se rule, but I think given the specific facts of this case that there should have been an expert.
Do you agree that the trial counsel did make some good points on cross-examination of the prosecution's expert and argued those pretty vociferously to the jury?
Yes, I think so, and I think Cheryl Ullman is a good lawyer. But I think the mistake was that she didn't know, because she didn't consult with an expert, that the basis for those theories that Cheryl Young presented were wrong. If she consulted with an expert, she would have known that the actual foundation for the theories that she was espousing were wrong, and could have either could have tailored her cross-examination towards that, or could have had the expert come in and testify.
Let me ask you this. Do you think if an attorney has reason to believe that he or she can punch holes in the expert's testimony, that he or she nonetheless has an obligation, acts unreasonably in failing to consult an independent expert?
I think in this case it was, because the testimony from Cheryl Ullman at the 35C hearing was that her cross-examination was inadequate because Cheryl Young was a slippery good witness for the prosecution. She used the word slippery. I think the obligation arises after they do the 403-702 hearing, where this evidence is coming in. She gets a look at how Cheryl Young testifies, how she can manipulate her answers and everything like that. I think that's where the alarm bells are raised, that you should maybe if I'm trial counsel, maybe I need to get an expert.
But let me ask you, maybe I need to get an expert. Is that the type of conclusion that ought to overcome the strong presumption of reasonableness that attends counsel's actions according to the Strickland standard?
I think in this case, the judge made the findings as far as the prejudice goes, and I think that's, in this case, I think it does.
Well, I wasn't addressing the prejudice standard. I was addressing, again, the serious deficiency. Remember, because we start with the presumption, a strong presumption, that counsel's actions are reasonable. And so what I was trying to ask is, you had said, well, maybe you should have consulted an expert. Is maybe the type of degree of confidence we should have to say there was a serious deficiency in defense counsel's performance?
And Judge, maybe I misspoke.
And maybe I put you on the horn too long. I'm sorry, counsel.
That's fine, Judge. I appreciate it. I can answer if you want.
I would. I'd appreciate it.
I think in this case, the facts of the case drive that you have an expert witness whose testimony was basically unrebutted and was devastating to the defense. I think given those facts, I think that counsel's obligation is at least to consult with an expert witness to see if there is, if they want to try to call them a trial to rebut what the prosecution's expert is talking about, or to consult with them in order to work on their cross-examination. There were issues that were unaddressed in cross-examination that may have been...
Okay, one final question.
Sure.
Was there any indication from the defense expert at 35C hearing that there was, in 2002, was that the trial date?
2003, August
2003, that there was in 2003 an expert in the area who would have been able to counter the testimony of Cheryl
Young. Yes, it was the defense expert, Saul Tompkins. If you look at the record, he's been around in Grand Junction since the 80s or 90s.
And he would have formed that opinion as of 2002. This is not a recent opinion?
I think based on his testimony that he would have right. come to the same conclusion.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Your Honor, let me see if I can first address Judge Berner on his question of whether remand or not on other issues. I think the record that was built at the 35 proceeding presented the issues that the defense thought were important and relevant to their presentation and effectiveness of the counsel. And as this court probably sees more often than I do, the defense had tried, because of the way time had run, now 35C is their only avenue of redress. They shoehorned literally dozens and dozens of issues under the rubric of ineffective assistance of counsel. So the key issues to the defense were presented, we argued them, so I think the record is replete with, or at least would be sufficient for this court to review those issues and find that this was in fact a fair adversarial process. The evidence was zealously advocated and litigated before the jury. The jury made its decision. And that the whole process is really, for people would argue, a model representation of how the adversarial process should work. At the end of that fair adversarial process, the defendant was convicted.
Well, before we go on, yes, didn't the post-conviction court seem to indicate that it thought there were some problems with the process? And wouldn't it be better if, as opposed to guess what the trial court thought might have been the problems with the process, that we remanded and say, please identify so that we can have appellate review, meaningful appellate review.
I can't disagree with that, except to the extent that there was full litigation below. And to the extent Judge O'Hara seemed to have been taken hostage by this case, seemed to have been concerned, as appears in his order at least, about the delay in the resolution, and I think hanging over the back of his head and really all of our heads is the indeterminate sentencing for sexual crimes. All of those things led him to look for the out. But the record we built at the 35C proceeding, I think, was adequately built by Mr. Jungi here. We responded as best we could to all of that, and I think it builds an adequate record for this court in the decision.
But in defense of the trial judge, I mean, you don't take light, even though Flora may prohibit it, consideration of it. I mean, it's not a small thing that the victim, who provided the real damning evidence against the defendant, is less than credible, and would have been even less credible if there were a new trial than at the original trial, because now she's recanted very serious allegations against her uncle and maybe others. I mean, that seemed to me to be what the trial judge was concerned about, and that's a matter of concern.
I fully agree with the court and appreciate that comment. Sexual assault victims are always, their credibility is always going to be central to the case. I can't, it just the nature of the cases with lack typically of forensic evidence, a lack of other witnesses, that is always going to be the case. But that was what Farrar talked about. Farrar dealt with that exact kind of case. And so I would argue the credibility is always going to be an issue. Judge O'Hara, and I agree with him, credibility is central, it's critical, this is really the only teaching, but it still doesn't meet the Farrar standard, I would argue.
Counsel, what was the trial counsel's explanation for why she did not consult with an independent expert once she had identified the prosecution's expert?
We were hamstrung by a couple of things. One is the trial defense counsel apparently lost their trial record, their own files, and so we didn't have access. My office didn't have access to them. She claimed, and I don't have any reason to disbelieve her, that somehow they've been lost in the last 10 or 11 years. My recollection of that testimony, I'd certainly invite the court to go back, but my recollection of it was she didn't exactly recall why. And moreover, she was pretty coy about her own conclusions about whether her representation was adequate or not. And she said she deferred the question essentially on the expert to say, when Judge O'Hara asked her, well, would you call your decision about this adequate? My recollection is her response was, that's for you to decide.
That's fine, but deferred. What explanation could she have had for not consulting with an expert once we find out that there's going to be an expert that will line up with some of the circumstances in your case?
Well, her strategy, as she testified and as we argued below, was, and I see my time's about running out.
Go ahead.
I'll continue. What she argued below was she was going to attack her on her credentials, which she did quite successfully both at the hearing pre-trial and during the trial. Hey, you're not a PhD. You're basing this all on your experience. You're not really a doctor or anything. And then she attacked the foundation of the evidence. But then she turned and she made some pretty significant points in her favor that she used in her own closing argument in support of her theory of the case that this was all fabricated. So that was her strategy, as far as I could tell. My recollection of her testimony, she did. I did ask her about those kinds of things, using our expert against us, and I would argue she did exactly that. May I just have 30 seconds to summarize?
Yes.
Yeah. So we're before this court asking that this court find that the trial judge applied, the 35C judge applied the wrong standard for new evidence. And that in a fair, objective, and complete look at the record, that this was a fair representation of the adversarial process, that the counsel was more than constitutionally adequate. And the extent that anything was bootstrapped over the threshold for granting a new trial by the use of cumulative evidence, that ought to be reversed as well. So at the end of the day, we're going to ask this court to reinstate its conviction and return to the Department of Corrections. I very much thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today and to raise these concerns with you. And I look forward to your resolution.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. Nice to see counsel from the Western Slope, where I practiced for 20 years. You did a nice job. Thank you very much. The case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.